Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. You know the old line about making assumptions, right? Here, I'll let Felix Unger from the old TV series The Odd Couple explain it.
Did I ask you for more money?
Well...
Ah!
Well, I mean, I just assumed that this man...
Did you say you assumed?
Yes.
You should never assume. Because when you assume, you make an ass of you and me.
And yet, we continue to assume. Most of us just assume that all Irish people are natural-born storytellers. They have the gift, you know? And we assume that everyone in Detroit is obsessed with cars, and that all New Yorkers are similarly obsessed with the subways. Well, I am here to tell you that in the next hour, you will find that all of those assumptions are correct. Irish writer Kevin Barry drops by to share a fun playlist in our regular Pick 3 feature, and we'll have a live set of catchy pop from the Detroit band whose name riffs on two of the most famous auto racers in American history. The band is called Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. Now, about those subways here in New York.
Don't sleep in the subway, darling. Don't stand in the
The subway, surprisingly, has provided inspiration for a number of songs, like this Petula Clark classic. It's also inspired a lot of album covers, and those are the focus of an exhibit at the New York Transit Museum in Brooklyn called Album Tracks. Get it? Album Tracks. In a moment, we'll speak with Latin soul king Joe Batan, who's part of the exhibit. But first, I'm joined here in the studio by the curator, Robert Del Bagno, director of exhibitions at the Transit Museum. Rob, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey, John.
Where did all this stuff come from?
All the records came from one collector who approached the Transit Museum and called and said he had a record collection of subway-related album covers. And... you know, I got to say, at first I was, you know, I wasn't bowled over by the idea, but I wanted to do due diligence, and I went to look at the albums, and as I started flipping through them, I enjoyed it. You know, it reminded me of, you know, there were a few that I had as a teenager, and I enjoyed looking through them, and then I realized, you know, if I'm enjoying this, other people are going to enjoy this, and so they have.
Please tell me this collector... collected other albums other than ones with Subway on the cover.
I believe he had other music that he listened to, but these albums he bought purely for the reason that the Subway was on the cover,
wow.
Which is interesting because it jumps around to all different genres of music that most people would like some but not all. And
right.
So he's got punk rock and rap and jazz and country music and...
like folk gospel
and,
stuff.
Yep. And some of them, you know, I don't think he's even ever listened to.
Okay. Now, many of these album covers look at the New York City subways in the 60s, the 70s, the early 80s, not the most flattering side of the New York City subway, you know, system.
Exactly. No, the subway couldn't look worse, really, in a body of work that you put together. But that was the heyday of album cover art. I mean, it started in the 40s. It went through the 80s. It's a short-lived time period where people bought records and the artwork on the cover was an important part of this. That doesn't go back to the early years when records were pressed, but companies hadn't thought about, you know, the cover being a selling point.
Right.
Yet.
So it was basically just to protect what were pretty fragile discs.
It was just packaging protect the disc. And then they realized, like every label on every jar, that this was a surface that they could communicate product by. And so it started in the late 30s. And by the 40s, you know, there was a picture of the band on the cover. by the 50s, it was starting to get much more creative and imaginative.
So how far back does this collection of subway art go?
This shows artwork 1955 to 1988.
Mm-hmm. So the Simon and Garfunkel album, Wednesday Morning 3 a.m., still relatively early in the kind of story of this exhibition. What is the cover, for folks who haven't seen it or don't have the album at home, what is the cover image on this Simon and Garfunkel record?
Simon and Garfunkel are in an empty train station. It turns out to be the 59th Street station, waiting for a train. And apparently this was inspired by late-night gigs in Greenwich Village, and they lived in Queens, and so they would be going home at 3 in the morning after the gig on the subway, and so that's the title of the album, Wednesday Morning 3 a.m.,
Which would subsequently become famous for containing the song Sound of Silence, although the original version of the song, without the drums and all that kind of stuff, was not the hit that it would later come to be.
And the people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made. And the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, tenement halls, whispered in the sounds of silence.
From Simon and Garfunkel, the original 1964 version of Sound of Silence, from the album Wednesday Morning, 3 a.m., Simon and Garfunkel looking for all the world like, you know, they're pretty tired. It could well have been 3 a.m. on a Wednesday morning when they took that cover shot. That album is part of the exhibition at the New York Transit Museum in Brooklyn called Album Tracks. We're speaking with Robert Del Bagno, who is the director of exhibitions there. There are like almost 40 record albums of record covers in the exhibit. One of them is Joe Bataan's 1969 album, Subway Joe. And Joe Bataan, the official king of Latin soul, is on the line with us. Hi, Joe.
How you doing, John?
I'm doing well. Subway Joe, what came first for you, that title or the song?
The title.
Really?
Actually, I was sitting down at the piano trying to reminisce about my days in New York, being a native New Yorker, and I said, what could I identify myself with through music that the mass of people in New York would know? And I thought, I said, gee, the subway, that's where the mass of people always congregate. So that was mass transportation. It was a no-brainer. I said, well, I'll call myself Subway Joe. And then I started to write the music and the lyrics. And, of course, the rest is history. I've been known as Subway Joe for many years.
Yeah. And also the king of Latin soul. Who crowns you king of Latin soul? How do you get that position?
Well, I guess that's a result of the public calling you different things throughout your career. You know,
yeah.
I've been doing this for over 46 years, and I'm blessed to be here talking to you. But, you know, people start, giving you monikers, and I guess that just attached to me.
All right. Well, but I also like Subway Joe. Why don't we hear a little bit of the song from the album of the same name, 1969 record by Joe Bataan. That is just a little bit of Subway Joe by Joe Bataan from his 1969 Boogaloo Latin Soul hit of the same name. So, Joe, let me understand the story here. Your guy is sitting on the subway. He spots a young woman, and she's looking pretty fine. All she wants is to sit down, and our guy is, like, hitting on her and doesn't realize he'll get a lot further if he just gives up his seat. Is that what's going on here?
He's just as tired as she is, and he doesn't want to get up. You know, he's had a long day's of work also. But when he remarks, stop eating up my mind, well, she gets upset, and I guess she hits him with the umbrella and kicks him in the knee.
So chivalry is dead, and by the end of the song, Subway Joe is half dead, too. He's bruised and battered.
Well, he tore his suit and knocked off his hat, so he was getting there.
Now, you hung out at the 103rd Street stop on the number 6 train, right?
That's right. That was one of our favorite hangouts in the old days because we used to do a lot of doo-wop singing in the train station because it had a natural echo chamber. So instead of going to a studio, we would go down to the subways to resonate our harmony. That was our stage.
Yeah. So, you know, being part of the subways, you know, that it certainly seems to make sense that this would be a part of the songwriting process. Where did you actually shoot the album cover?
Well, you know, we looked for a favorite spot, and when we had to think about it, what was the most congested spot in New York? So we decided it had to be Times Square. So that's on 42nd Street between 7th and 8th Avenue. And then I got to correct you on the date. It's 1967.
67. Okay.
Right.
So you guys were, you know, pretty much, you were a little ahead of the curve still in 1967 because, Rob, a lot of the albums in the exhibit are from, like, the 70s, and it goes up to what, maybe the mid-80s?
Mid-80s, you know, and then, you know, the CD takes over and the cover art, you know, just stopped being important.
Well, also
point.
The subways stopped being the sort of, I mean, they seem to really be a kind of signifier of urban grit and, you know, street cred before that was even a term.
Well, that's exactly what a lot of these bands were looking for in a background to shoot in. And the subway back in the graffiti days, you know, it said New York and it said urban.
Yeah.
And urban contemporary in the 70s was actually what, you know, a new musical genre or radio format that I think WBLS started in New York. You know, kind of a hybrid of a lot of different music, which is exactly what Joe Bataan was, and why I think it's so perfect for him to identify with the subway.
Joe did the rhythms. I mean, having sung doo-wop harmonies in that 103rd Street stop on Lexington Avenue, did the rhythms of the train actually kind of work their way into the songwriting at some point?
Well, yes, tempo-wise. You know, you can hear the putter of the trains going. And, of course, that contributed to the beat. And because it was just the atmosphere, everything just filled in because everybody identified with the subways in New York.
Yeah. Well, Joe, thank you very much for joining us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you, John.
Joe Bataan's album, Subway Joe, 1967 record, part of this exhibit at the New York Transit Museum. The director of exhibitions is Robert Del Bagno here with me in the studio. Do you have favorites among these, among this collection?
Well, there's two that I owned as a kid. Actually, I still own them. I was never able to get rid of my record collection. So the Ramones' Subterranean Jungle and the Velvet Underground Loaded.
All right, now let me ask you about that Ramones cover because, you know, I've heard the story of this, and when you hear the backstory and then look at the cover, it's like, oh, yeah, it's so obvious. But tell us what the story of that album cover is.
Well, the band is posed on a subway train, and the photo's taken, and it's 1985, and the MTA at this point has cleaned up the graffiti from the subways and trains. So the train was not graffitied, but the art director then put the title and the Ramones' name in graffiti on top of the train. And when Johnny Ramone saw this, he thought it looked really fake and said, I hate the fake graffiti.
He's
You've
got to
fire
right.
this guy. And the record company, interestingly, just ignored the band and put the album out as is. And that's what we see today.
Now when you're feeling low and the fish won't die, you need a little soul to put you back.
little bit from the Ramones, Subterranean Jungle. Again, in retrospect, you know, knowing the story, you look at the graffiti on the subway car and it's like so clearly put in later. All right, so Rob, you said that is one of your favorites in this collection called Album Tracks. And the other, going all the way back to 1970, is the album Loaded by the Velvet Underground. Tell us about this cover.
Well, this was an interesting one. It's a strange album cover given this album, because the Velvet Underground were, even though people in New York loved them in the bars, and you know, today we think of them in such revered terms, but they actually weren't selling a lot of albums in their early days, and their record label dropped them after their first two albums. Mm-hmm. They had just decided, you know, we don't want this hippie drug music, and you know, we want bands that make money. And so Atlantic Record picked them up under the condition that they do a commercially viable album that will sell nationwide.
Loaded with hits.
So they were trying to get this national exposure, so it's almost a little odd that they have a New York City subway entrance on the album cover. And Lou Reed became so disgusted with this album and the trying to make hits, which it actually did, and he quit the band. And mm-hmm. Lou Reed went on to his solo career.
What is the subway station on the cover? What is that entrance? Do we know?
I don't know if it's anyone in particular. It has some oddities. We tried to identify every album cover, and I think the artist here, who actually did a lot of different album covers in the 60s and 70s, you know, I think he kind of referenced a subway entrance and then did his own thing with it.
Well, you know, and Velvet Underground were asked to produce some hits, and by their standards, they did, you know, songs that did well then and are now considered classics, like Sweet Jane and this one, Rock and Roll.
Jenny said when she was just 5 years old, there was nothing happening at all. Every time she puts on the radio, there was nothing going down at all. Not at all. Then one fine morning, she puts on a New York station. You know, she don't believe what she heard at all. She started shaking to that fine, fine music. You know, her life was saved by rock and roll.
Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground with Rock and Roll from their album Loaded, sporting a kind of, what would you say, stylized New York City subway entrance on the cover, Rob?
Yeah, a little psychedelic.
Yeah, a little psychedelia. Yeah. The exhibit is called Album Tracks, Subway Record Covers. It runs through January 12th at the Transit Museum in Brooklyn, and Robert Del Bagno is the director of exhibitions. The exhibit ends just as hip-hop is emerging into the broader consciousness, and Grandmaster Flash with The Source is kind of, is this the period at the end of the sentence?
Well, for album cover art, I think yes, that, you know, that hip-hop was really becoming a dominant music right as we started to switch from albums to CDs, and you know, artists were employed to do CD covers, but honestly, you know, you don't remember them. They don't have the visual impact that the 12-inch square had.
Right.
So, you know, it's no longer, it's a different kind of a thing. It's not the cultural artifact that the album cover was.
Which is too bad because, you know, most of us who grew up in New York at that time first heard hip-hop on the subways. You know, I would hear, you know, guys come through with their cassette decks and later boom boxes, and that was where you first heard it.
That's certainly where I first heard it. But, you know, back in the day when people were had boom boxes instead of listening to their phones, and music listening was much more of a communal thing, not a personal thing. So you did get turned on to a lot of new music that way.
Of course, it was legal back in those days. And at some point it was made illegal to play a radio or a boom box on the subway.
Yeah, I think right around that time.
Right around that time. Grandmaster Flash from just around that time, 1985, with this excerpt from The Source.
We're Grandmaster Flash. We're giving you a blast of class. Huh. And if you want to know why we're on top of the pile, because we got style. Yves Saint Laurent, Pierre Cardin, the Chandlers, Colby's, and the Carringtons. Styles, not Gucci or Louis Vuitton, imported straight from the Bronx, and my name's the Bomb. Creole with a few words I like to voice, and Austin or LaRosa, my particular choice. Got style and finesse, and I'm sure you'll agree, nobody ever, never, ever rhymed quite like me. We're Grandmaster Flash. We're giving you a blast of class.
Grandmaster Flash with style, incorporating, of course, the Peter Gunn theme from the Grandmaster Flash album, The Source. This exhibit seems to be split, Rob, between genuine subway covers and ones like this, which are the elevated parts of the subway system.
Well, a lot of the subway system in the outer boroughs are elevated trains, not underground. And the boroughs are a big source of a lot of where these musicians came from.
Right.
People, you know, Brooklyn, the Bronx were big sources of the hip-hop culture and the funk. And
so you guys have identified Upper Manhattan as the site of this album cover, right?
Yeah, I was assuming it was the Bronx, being Grandmaster Flash,
right.
But I think we determined it was 184th Street.
All right. So is anybody doing this anymore? I mean, have you seen anything post-1985 or 6?
Yeah. I mean, people actually use the trains that are in the New York Transit Museum for photo shoots, and it does still happen. I think more like music video and movie shoots, though not so much shooting an album cover.
But there is this live band karaoke thing you guys are doing on Wednesday the 16th at the Transit Museum from 6 to 9 p.m., where the karaoke singers can pose for their own album covers in some of the vintage subway cars that you have there. The exhibit, though, Album Tracks, Subway Record Covers, runs through January 12th at the Transit Museum in Brooklyn. Robert Del Bagno is the director of exhibitions there, and it's a, you know, it's a fun exhibit. You can take it in a short period of time. Well done.
Thanks, John.
I was going to catch a train in the subway when I hear a strange song coming from down there. So I see people, so I hear music. The young and the old, if you see antics, Scoobie, Mike and Jemot, Messiah, Sugar Finger, all them DJ take over. Imagine them DJ have New York subway like Eastern Park, well, every day. Trinidad and jamming down in the subways. Antigua and jamming down in the subways. Keep patience back up in New York subways. Let's back up the New York subway. The sniffers and the drinkers and the smokers and the whiners of it.
Next, the band that takes its name from NASCAR royalty. We'll hear a live performance from Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. And we'll give the group a pop quiz. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Time for today's live music session here in the Soundcheck studio. Detroit band Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. made their debut 2 years ago with the album It's a Corporate World. Now they're back with a new record called The Speed of Things. And they're going to start things off here in our New York studio with a live performance of a song called simply Run. Here's Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr.
said, I keep collecting stuff, my house is full of all I've acquired. Said, I hope to master this, I am a soldier, you see, always ordering chaos. Said, I got a secret room where I can be myself with someone I've rented. So the only thing that really gets me off is painful enough to feel pleasure. Was it good for you? Was it good for you? So I went back and drew a bath and tried to see about just how clean I could make my offering.
That is Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. here in our Soundcheck studio with their song Run, which you will find on the new album from the band. It's called The Speed of Things, and it's out now. Josh Epstein singing and playing guitar. Josh, good to see you again.
Nice to see you again.
And Daniel Zott behind our piano. How's it treating you there, Daniel?
It's a beautiful piano.
All right. Daniel's doing lead vocals as well. Backing vocals and bass and drums, courtesy of John Visker and Mike Higgins, respectively. And, guys, it's been a couple of years since you were last here. It was around the time of the first record. This second one is, you know, it's got a kind of a different texture to it somehow. I mean, how different was the process of making this record?
Making this record was entirely different from the first, because the first was this kind of happy accident, mm-hmm. where... We didn't really know.
Speaking of accidents, did you accidentally leave a delay on your microphone? It's in the control room. They've taken care of it. So now you can speak and not sound like you're in, like,
great.
You know, one of those old ballparks.
Yeah.
No. Batting second.
It was kind of fun. It gave me a flashback of our national anthem we just sang.
Now, you guys, you did the national anthem at for the Tigers,
we
right?
We did, yeah. That was like the biggest honor ever.
It was amazing.
Was it? It was before the playoffs, right?
Yeah, it was game 3 of the ALDS,
mm-hmm.
Which we lost. So that kind of tainted.
We'll never be able to go back.
You lost that game.
We lost the game,
but you won that series.
We won the series.
Incredible
game.
That's the
important thing. Yeah,
that's all that counts.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, getting back to the record.
Sure. Yeah.
You say it's different.
The important stuff. our manager must be behind me, making sure you get on point.
So
make sure you mention it's for sale.
So why was it different?
It was entirely different because the first time felt like such a happy accident. We were just kind of getting together when we could, maybe every other week, every 3 weeks, once a month, and making these songs. We'd probably record them in a day and then not really think about them too much. And this one, we really felt like we wanted to we wanted to think about what we wanted to make, and then we wanted to try and, you know, fully realize a vision.
Now, does that ever happen in art where you think you have the, and, you know, once you've actually created the thing, you look back and say, that's not what I intended at all?
I think that's always the case. I think you think, I think it's just good that we worked harder than we've ever worked. And I think we intended on going and trying certain things. But sometimes when you try to hit a target, and you totally miss, at least you come up with something that you never would have come up with by just, you know, not trying to hit that goal.
Yeah.
And so I think in a lot of ways, that's what made it sound a little bit different on this record, is we were shooting a lot higher for this, or we got a bunch of new equipment, and it sonically just sounds better because of that as well.
Mm-hmm. The album's called The Speed of Things. It is out now. I'm sure you guys have been busy, you know, singing the national anthem for the Tigers, putting the record together, being on tour. You have had time to send out some interesting tweets. One of them consisted of some pretty familiar lyrics. Siga cigar, right from Cuba, Cuba, I just bite it, it's for the look, I don't light it. From the Will Smith classic, Getting Jiggy With It. So, are you guys fans?
First of all, let me just say props to your research department for that.
You can thank
for digging that up.
You can thank our producer, Katie, who was scanning your Twitter feed.
And probably loves the song.
Yeah. Actually, that for some reason, Mike Higgins, our drummer, was talking about that song and those lyrics, but he got them totally wrong. He said something like, I don't bite it, or, you know, I don't smoke it, something like that. And then the song came on in the dad van that we rented while we were in New York.
Speaking of weird things happening, we thought we would present you guys with a couple of quotes and ask you to determine whether this is Will Smith or Will Shakespeare.
Wow.
Awesome.
Now, you think you know your Will Smith from your Will Shakespeare?
I can tell this is going to be really hard.
All right. Here's the first one.
You guys are going to make this incredibly hard, but let's go for it.
From the deepest of the darkest of night, on the horizon, bright light enters sight. Will Smith or Will Shakespeare?
That sounds like Will Smith from Independence Day.
Very well done. It's actually Will Smith from Men in Black.
Yes.
But you know you're Will Smith.
He's in too many alien movies.
Yeah.
All right. Love all, trust a few, do wrong to none.
That's Shakespeare.
Very good, Daniel. That is Shakespeare. All's well that ends well. One more. Drinks on me, up the cups, and midnight coming full thrust.
Oh, no.
That's the trickiest one.
Can we get a phone a friend here?
Yeah. Nancy?
Shakespeare or Smith?
I'm just going to go with Smith.
No, I think it's Shakespeare, but let's go.
Josh is correct. Josh, it's Will Smith.
I knew you guys were going to be tricky about it.
All right, I got one more.
That's super tricky. That
last one. God bless Mother Nature. She's a single woman, too. She took off to heaven, and she did what she had to do.
That does not sound like Shakespeare to me.
That doesn't sound like Will Smith either, though.
You guys are good. It is, in fact, the Weather Girls. Yes. From their hit song, It's Raining Men.
Oh, hallelujah.
Dale Earnhardt Jr., you guys passed the test with flying colors and can therefore remain in our studio and play another song for us.
All right.
the album's called The Speed of Things. Dale Earnhardt Jr. is playing in their hometown of Detroit on Saturday, November 23rd at the Jack White Theater, and of course, playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. This song is called A Haunting.
I don't want you to be like all the ones before. I don't want it to get back to your sisters and your friends back home. But if you'd come back and haunt me, I would swear I heard you talking through the walls again. All night I'd be pretending every noise I heard was just your ghost. Oh, all the ones before. I don't want to get back to all the thugs and all your crew back home. But if you come back and haunt me, I could see you stand before me like a hooligan. I could hear you with an understanding unlike any that I've known. I just want to feel somebody. I just want my body to be overcome for once. I just want to be possessed by all the spirit that I still don't know. But if you would come back and haunt me, I could feel you running through me like I never did. I could finally know you just the way you always needed to be known.
That again is the Detroit-based band called Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr., live in our New York studio on Soundcheck with their song A Haunting. The album, The Speed of Things, is out. Guys, it's been a lot of fun having you with us here in the studio. Thanks for coming in and playing once again.
Thanks. This is such a fun show.
This is an honor, really, to be here.
Check out the online version of today's session to hear an additional song by Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. Just head over to soundcheck.org or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Up next, we ask the Irish writer Kevin Barry to compile a short playlist of favorite songs. He joins us with his pick three next.
Three, that's a magic number. Yes, it is. It's the magic number.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This week's Pick 3 playlist comes to us from the award-winning Irish novelist and writer Kevin Barry. His first novel, City of Bohane, was set in a dystopian near future, but his brand new short story collection, Dark Lies the Island, focuses in on outcasts living their everyday lives in a more recognizable present, often in Ireland. Kevin Barry, welcome to our New York studios.
It's great fun to be here. Thanks, John.
So, Dark Lies the Island, it's a collection of short stories. Is it like sequencing an album when you have a bunch of little pieces like this and you need to present them in a certain way?
I'm completely channeling Marvin Gaye when I'm sequencing a book of short stories. I'm thinking about my favorite records and I'm Marvin and 71 putting What's Going On together, you know? I'm going to open up really, really soft. I'm going to lure them in gently and then going to hit them. It horrifies me when readers come back and say, but we don't read the collection in sequence. And I go, do you realize the sleepless nights I spend sequencing in my head, you know? That's so, actually the best fun of it is deciding on the sequence, I think.
So wait, so people come up to you and basically they say they've been reading the book on shuffle?
Yeah, pretty much on shuffle. They say, okay, well, I have half an hour. This is 10 pages. I'll get through that. You know, and it's okay. Like, so I please urge you out there, short story readers, read in sequence.
So Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, is that a touchstone record for you?
It would be. It would be. It, you know, I always think with music is a mode of transport. It brings you back to certain times and certain places in your life, and Marvin brings me back to kind of early 90s, and I'm crawling home from nightclubs in Cork City at 5 a.m. in various states of disrepair. And what do you put on in the last hour before you go to sleep, you know? And it would tend to be Marvin at that time. Just right, just perfect.
Talk to me, so you can see.
There's, you know, although a lot of us didn't know it at the time because you would hear that song on the radio and it was just like a pretty song, but there's storytelling going on.
Absolutely,
there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there's this great, you know, tradition of Irish music that has that storytelling aspect as well. How did you end up telling stories without music?
Yeah, I mean, it really, I think it's a very common thing I find talking to writers is that they're terrible singers. And they've failed musicians. And it's a kind of a displacement activity, I think. Very often we want to be on stage, we want to perform, but we just haven't got the chops for that. Uh-huh. So we write instead.
Did you give it a go when you were in high school?
I was in many terrible bands and I can't sing. I sound like a crow being strangled, you know. It's, but I like to perform. I like to read the stories. And it's and a melody and tune is very important to me in my stories, in my writing. That's what I'm looking for all the time.
Now, is that why so many of these stories are set outside of, like, you know, major cities like Dublin, where there's a kind of a flat affect to the speech?
Sure.
And, yeah. And they're set instead in regional places, yeah, where dialect is still strong?
Yeah. And I mean, I guess I come from the west of Ireland myself, and I work very much with the ear as a writer. It all comes in at the ear. And I let the sound dictate the story. I'm very happy to change the meaning of a sentence for the sake of how it sounds, and I will trace it along line by line and try and pick out the melody of a story, I guess.
We're speaking with the Irish writer Kevin Barry. His new collection of short stories is called Dark Lies the Island, and he's picked a Pick 3 playlist for us that begins actually right here in New York with Blondie.
Yes. What really interests me sometimes in music is when you have different strains that miscegenate and that crossbreed. And the track I've picked, what you have there is you have the kind of 70s disco coming out of the gay clubs in New York, big pounding, throbbing bass lines, getting mixed up with Lower East Side, with the CBGB's new wave kind of setup, and the two coming together and creating for me one of the touchstone tracks for New York City. I think it makes me think of New York, and it makes me think of Deborah Harry.
And the album Parallel Lines, man, that still stands up pretty well.
Amazing record. Yeah. It's an amazing record.
This was probably the best known song from it. Heart of Glass from Blondie.
We'll be right back.
Lines, the 1978 record by Blondie, and the hit single Heart of Glass, picked for us by the Irish writer Kevin Barry. See, you were getting all of this stuff in Cork or there?
Yeah,
in the West Country.
At that point I would have been grown up in Limerick City in a house full of older sisters who were teenagers at that time. I was like 9 or 10. But Radio Luxembourg would have been the station that we would have been picking up the pop stuff on. Mm-hmm. And a golden era, you know, and your brain is a sponge at that age. And
of course,
the stuff that gets in there at that time stays forever, you know.
Yeah. Do you listen to music? Can you listen to music when you're writing?
You know, for a long while I couldn't, and I didn't even try. And then I talked to lots of other writers and I go, no, give it a go. It kind of does something for your concentration. So I did start trying. I can't listen to music with lyrics because that will distract me. It'll pull me out of my own story into somebody else's. But I can listen to more rhythmic, instrumental stuff. And I guess my big thing of all forms is kind of dub reggae and 70s Trojan Records. Almost anything from that label, I'm kind of in heaven. And I will listen to that stuff as I write. And I think, I hope that it kind of infects the prose at some level and some of that rhythm gets in there. Hmm. That slow kind of skank, you know. This is my fondest hope anyway.
So a lot of that music does have lyrics, though. Mm. So how do you deal with that?
There's lots of great box sets, as you probably know, of Trojan, and you've got lots of dub instrumentals and stuff there. Where the
vocal track has been sort of washed out and you get all these reverby effects and
King
stuff.
King Tubby, Lee Scratch Perry, you know, all these guys going at it. Just amazing.
All right, so from Trojan Records, you told us to pick anything.
Sure.
So we went with Desmond Dekker.
Great stuff.
The late Desmond Dekker.
Yeah.
Best known for the Israelites, but this is a later song from 1970, and it's called You Can Get It If You Really Want.
Succeed at last. Don't you know me? Listen, Rome was not built in a day. Opposition will come your way. But the hotter the battle you see, be the sweeter the victory. You can get it if you really want.
The late Desmond Dekker singing You Can Get It If You Really Want, Jimmy Cliff song from 1970 on the Trojan record label, home to some great calypso and dub reggae. And Kevin Barry, the Irish writer, telling us that this is what he likes to listen to, this sort of stuff, usually the more instrumental things, though,
writing. Yeah. And Irish people actually like to claim a little bit of the reggae heritage for themselves because there was a large Irish exodus.
I can't wait to hear this.
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
Huge Irish exodus to Jamaica in the 1700s. We went out and stole land and tried to set up farms around there. And in fact, the father of Mr. Robert Marley had Irish heritage.
Oh.
So we're claiming Bob.
All right.
Bob is part of the Irish diaspora. I'm here to tell you now.
Now, you recently were here in New York doing something with Craig Finn, the lead singer of The Hold Steady.
The wonderful Craig Finn from The Hold Steady. We did a kind of a conversation down in Brooklyn at the Greenlight Bookstore. It was an amazing night. It was kind of lots of shared kind of heritage. Craig has an Irish background and also so a fondness for kind of barroom tall tales.
Oh, man, his albums. He's one of the great storytellers
of
indie rock, you know.
Yeah. We had a really interesting talk about process and how you go about it and how you can't try too hard often with stories. You just have to leave them percolate and season at the back of your mind and be patient and wait for them to come. But tremendous band and a really great guy, actually. It was a really cool event.
So you were a fan? You knew?
Yeah. I mean, I think I first got wind of The Hold Steady with the track Sequestered in Memphis a few years ago. Amazing song.
From the album Stay Positive, yeah.
And then picking up Stay Positive and from there going back into their catalog.
Separation Sunday, which is basically like a novel
for
sorts.
Sure, yeah. really amazing band, and I think a tremendous singer. I think he's a really good singer.
So you guys were talking about process. Did you find, I mean, are there sort of major differences in the process of writing a short story or writing a song or writing a novel on one hand and writing a concept album on the other?
Yeah, I think there's probably more similarities than there are differences in some ways. I mean, for me as a writer going between short stories and novels, and I also write scripts, short stories are really hard. You can be looser and more wild and take tangents in a novel. With a short story, every sentence is bearing weight as you move along. And if you let one slip, the whole edifice can come crumbling down. So most of mine go wrong. I let about one out of 10 out the door, you know, that's it.
So there are basement tapes is what you're telling us.
I call them zombie stories, half-dead stories crawling around the house in County Sligo.
Kevin Barry is with us on Soundcheck. His latest collection of short stories is called Dark Lies, The Island. And he's been sharing a pick three with us. And the third of your pick three is that great Irish band, The Pogues, who recently lost a member, and it was not the one we all thought it would be.
No, I mean, everybody thought Shane was going to go years ago, and he's going strong. But very sadly, just in the last couple of weeks, Philip Chevron passed away at the tragically early age of 56 after an illness that had stretched on for a couple of weeks. Couple of months back in Dublin, a lot of people came together and had a big, wonderful benefit concert for Philip in the Olympia Theatre in Dublin City. Really poignant night. I couldn't make it. I was away. But an amazing night. You two showed up. Everybody showed up. He was brilliant influence on the Pogues and what he brought into the Pogues. But also before that, with a great Dublin band called the Radiators from Outer Space. Mm. One of the great Irish punk bands from starting in the late 70s, I think. And a tremendous songwriter. He's a guy who never quite got the weight of reputation he deserved, but an utter gentleman and a very dapper man.
Yeah.
You would spot him around Dublin in like a blue velvet suit and on a grey wet Tuesday and just go, yeah, that's what you need to do.
So he was the yin to Shane McGowan's yang, toothless front man of the
Pogues. And what he really brought out in a really interesting way for the Pogues was Philip Chevron was someone who taught deeply about music and where it came from. And he saw the Pogues as the classic Irish immigrant band in London who were influenced by what he called the Camden jukebox. You know, West Indian influences coming in. All of these influences from everywhere and how they melted together to create a crazy sound often that was the Pogues.
Well, this is from the classic Pogues album, Rum, Sodomy and the Lash from 1985. It's A Pair of Brown Eyes.
And the arms and legs of honor.
That is The Pogues, led by singer Shane McGowan and the recently deceased guitarist Phil Chevron. A Pair of Brown Eyes, the name of the song from their 1985 record Rum, Sodomy and the Lash, picked for us by the Irish writer Kevin Barry here in our Soundcheck studio. What's your feeling about the kind of the received Irish tradition? Because, you know, you have
some of your
characters seem to feel ambiguous of the innkeeper who goes out to the West Coast and hates it.
yeah. And, you know, I often think that Irish writers are up against some of the same difficulties that writers from the American South are up against, right? Because you have to record a speech and you have to be faithful to it. But when you put Irish speech on the page, it can look like you're overdoing it, you know, because we are mellifluous and we like to talk and we like to put it out there and it's very rhythmic. But at the same time, we say very little, you know, and we give very little away. And underneath all this lovely musical talk, there are always these secret little power battles and taunts going on, you know. And listening to Irish men talk is very interesting. And I'm always reminded of a great Norman Mailer line, and I think he could have been specifically talking about Irishmen when he said, whenever two men say hello to each other in the street, one of them loses. And that's what it's like listening to Irishmen. So an awful lot of my work comes out of conversation, listen to what's been said and what's not being said.
Yeah. And the sort of Irish folk tradition, as it's sort of come down, is that part of that, you know...
There's no denying it. We're storytelling people. And yeah. People ask, why does that storytelling tradition exist? Why is it so rich? And it sounds like quite a pat thing to say, but the weather is not insignificant. It rains 300 days a year. We're indoors quite a bit. If you didn't make stuff up, you'd go nuts. You know? So you have to... The island of Ireland creates ideal conditions for a nation of fabulists and storytellers. Yeah.
Well, dark lies the island, as they say, or as you say. The collection is called Dark Lies the Island, short stories by the award-winning Irish writer Kevin Barry, who's been sharing a pick three with us here on Soundcheck today. Kevin, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
It's been a hoot, John. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll get a visit from Joan Jett, the guitarist and singer behind the Runaways and the Blackhearts, joins us to talk about a new album called Unvarnished. Plus, Eagles. No, not the Southern California smooth rockers, the British punk band. They're in town for this year's CMJ Music Marathon, and they'll stop by to play a live set in our studio. Hope you'll join us then. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.